I'm Molly Wood, and welcome to The Source Code. This is the place where we like to give you the uncut, full-length versions of the interviews we air on Marketplace Tech that we think are especially noteworthy and that we think you, our listeners, will be extra interested in. Today's is Chamath Palihapitiya. If the name sounds familiar, it's because Palihapitiya recently said that he regrets how social media, including Facebook, was built to addict users. It should be noted here that Palihapitiya is a former Facebook executive. He said it had been turned into a tool for misinformation that is destroying how society works. He later clarified those remarks to be about the unintended consequences of tech. But Palihapitiya is also the founder of a venture capital firm called Social Capital. It focuses on healthcare, education, and tech with a larger purpose. And basically, he believes that guys like him who made a lot of money in tech should fund venture firms so they can have a positive impact on what comes next. We talked a lot about that. And so here is Chamath Palihapitiya, The Source Code.
Hi, Molly.
Hi. Okay, so let's talk about Social Capital. You started it in 2011. In a nutshell, what were your goals?
Well, when I first left Facebook, the thing that I wanted to do was take advantage of what I had learned there, but apply it to a lot more things than just social media. And I learned kind of two things. One was how to build systems much more bottoms up. And so I just wanted to do that in areas that, frankly, had not seen the positive effects of modern technology, so areas like healthcare and education and financial services. That was one thing. And then the second thing that I had learned at Facebook was how to actually make businesses much better. And we did that by using a lot of data and machine learning. And so I thought that if we put those two practices together, investing in some really hard parts of the economy that needed fixing, but do it in a way where we could bring a lot of learning and knowledge, we could not just make a lot of money, but do it as a byproduct, frankly, of making a lot of impact.
Just out of curiosity, is any of that meant as a criticism to Facebook?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, like, look, I helped build a $500 billion company, and a lot of people would say that I deserve a lot of the credit. That's great. But, look, I had spent 15 years on the consumer internet. My fingerprints are on three of the top 15 or 20 consumer, businesses, biggest businesses of all time. But like everything, it's kind of like, it runs its course. And to be honest, I was so intellectually fatigued with consumer internet by the time I left Facebook in 2011. I really did just want a new challenge. And, working on things like diabetes and cancer, working on the problems of sort of like, educational reform, more inclusive access to capital. To me, it just expands what I do well, which is kind of be creative and problem solve in a technical way, but just apply it to things that I didn't know as well. And frankly, it's gotten me a lot more energized about how I spend my time every day.
And when you started the firm, I mean, part of what you wanted to do was change the system, right? You said you wanted, for example, a pool of capital that was exceedingly patient. What does that mean exactly?
Well, I think that there's if you take a sort of a much broader step back and you ask the question like, how is capitalism working today? And I would say it's working a lot less well than it used to. And specifically what happens is there's a lot of hoarding of money that happens. And at the same time that there's a lot of short-term ways in which money is allocated. And the entire financial services industry, unfortunately, has vectored around these two things. And the byproduct of that is that you don't really invest in enough of the things that should be invested in, and you don't see enough of the longitudinal bets being taken. So just to, even take technology, we celebrate a good friend of mine, Elon Musk, amazingly well. But what's tragic is there are so many other people that should also have been funded in the same way. Now, what Elon was able to bring to 15 years now of investment into things like science, into things like space, into things like batteries and electronic vehicles was his own capital, which was clearly exceedingly patient. And I can do the same thing. But what's unfortunate is, both he and I still have to convince umpteen numbers of people that the things that we are collectively working on are worthwhile. The problem is that the people that control the money are not rewarded for making 15-year bets. They're rewarded for making year-long bets. And as a result, their entire framework of value is reoriented around very short-term and frankly, risk-adjusted decision-making around making sure that their compensation is protected. And unfortunately, when that happens at a large enough scale, what you do is you retard progress of society. You slow down the advent or the acceleration of technologies. You do not allow markets to reform. So, a very clear thing that I wanted to do in the allocation of my own money is to convince others that this is the better way. That at the end of a 10 or 15 year period, you'll look back and you will actually have made more, but you will have done it in a much more constructive and repeatable way for society.
Aren't most funds 10-year funds?
I think the more important implication is most funds are run by people who are employed by their limited partners. Not enough funds are actually run by people who control their own money.
So you don't have LPs?
We have some, but the majority of the money comes from myself. Now, the reason why that's important is when you look at the meaningful step function changes that Silicon Valley has brought to the world, particularly in the 60s, 70s, 80s, what you had was a large amount of venture capitalists who were allocating a significant amount of their own capital. And to the extent that they had limited partners, those limited partners were not necessarily traditional institutional capital, but what they were other like-minded entrepreneurs who felt a responsibility to pay it forward. And I think that what's great is if we could find a hybrid which allows people like that, i.e. people like me, to put our own money to work, put our money where our mouth is, to find other like-minded entrepreneurs who believe that it's important to sort of push technology forward aggressively, and then to partner that up with institutional capital. And that partnership, I think, is the best way. Because if it's too much institutional capital, then I think what happens is you revert to short-term risk-biased decision-making for managing against losses. And then that creates a risk-averse culture. And then that manifests in managing to, you know, simple, obvious ideas. And then what that means is the non-obvious big ideas get ignored. And so you can see that negative feedback loop is something that is actually avoidable. And if you trace it back to the root cause, I think it's about the sources of capital and the duration of risk that that source of capital is willing to take.
It doesn't sound like a super repeatable model in the sense that it relies on individuals having a lot of money. I think some people would make the argument that, for example, there could be more risky thinking if you introduce more diversity into the pool of investors.
Well, that is absolutely true. I mean, I think what happens is, look, there's a lot of money that's been made by venture capitalists. The problem is that I think that they're by and large a lot that's, you know, not that risk seeking. You know, they've largely, particularly this generation of venture capitalists, and if you look at them, you'll see, you know, it's littered with, you know, people with very, very little operational experience. They're highly credentialed in a very traditional hierarchical way. You know, they went to MBA school. They worked at some, you know, fancy blue chip investment bank or consulting firm, but they frankly have not done anything. And the problem with those folks is that when they make money, it is so part of their identity that they refuse to take any risk with it. And I think one could argue that that's probably not the most constructive way to think about money. You could actually say it's actually an instrument of change, and you should actually view it more as a custodian versus as a, you know, system that defines who you are as a person. So I think that if you then, you know, say to yourself, well, there's two ways to fix it. One vector is to actually have more risk-seeking entrepreneurial people amongst the classes of investors. And I think that's happening slowly. Myself, Joe Lonsdale, there's a bunch of folks that have principally gone off, you know, from an entrepreneurial bent and used their own capital to start investing. And I think we're starting to do increasingly interesting things with it. But at the same time, it's exactly what you said would be helpful, which is to have a more inclusive and diverse investor mindset. And that comes from people who aren't traditionally, you know, as credentialed or as obvious of a, you know, kind of like blue chip checkboxing background, but frankly are more dynamic and more risk-seeking. You know, one of the best things that happened to me in my life is I grew up on welfare, which divorced myself from, you know, having to have a codependent relationship with money because I didn't have any money. And I actually think that you know, a broader set of people who have very, very diverse backgrounds who are, you know, who come at it with very different relationships with money can then actually do exactly as you say, allocate and take much more risk because they are not defined by it.
Is it about risk or is it about mindset? When I hear you talk about individuals putting in a lot of capital and maybe partnering with institutional investors, it's hard not to hear that as something that would keep money in power with people who already have it.
Well, what's your alternative?
So that's what I'm asking is if you get a broader set of...
Here's the thing, Molly. Like, look, if you want to do good things in the world, like, there's just only so much time that one can spend being glass half empty.
Sure.
And so, like, I'm trying to live my life basically asking myself the question, at least is it incrementally better than the status quo? If it is, like, you know, sniping and chiding from the sidelines is not constructive. So I guess what I would ask is, what is a better alternative?
I'm asking if a more diverse pool of people who have a more equal opportunity to raise funds and then invest those funds can also exist alongside this model. Or do you feel like this is the only model?
No, but I think what you're saying and what I'm saying are the same thing. I want a different class of people at the table. I also want people who are principals versus agents putting their own money on the line to actually reflect their worldview. I think that's a much more constructive place than a highly entrenched, cloistered, institutional class of agents working on behalf of other agents. That does not work because that is a system we have today.
How hard is it to change that system? Because it is a system we have today. And like you said, a lot of people are getting rich. So what do you encounter?
It's actually not that hard.
Yeah?
It's actually not that hard. And
that's good
reason
news.
Is because at the end of the day, the unit of value is the entrepreneur. And what's beautiful about these people as a class is they are increasingly open-minded, increasingly diverse, increasingly open to change. They want to completely reframe problems in really novel ways. And who they want to partner with, frankly, are people like me, because we empathize about the same things and we have such a shared, unified moral and ethical worldview. And when you partner with those people and then they are successful, then the institutional capital and all the hordes of capital that are maybe, you know, like them, capitulate. Because while, you know, some may want the change, some may not want the change, they all want the same thing, which is to be able to fund their obligations. Whether those obligations are their charities, their pensions, you know, they need returns in a world that doesn't generate them, quite honestly, in literally every asset class except technology. So I would love to say that we're changing hearts and minds. It's probably not entirely true. They just look at our returns and they're like, okay, I got to be beside these guys. And, you know, I'm going to have to deal with some bursty, you know, commentary along the way. And that's okay. Like I said, I see the glasses half full. And I'm like, at least it's one step closer to a much more broader, inclusive capitalist system that should work for many, many more people. And, you know, I'm just not going to like wait for the perfect and let that be the enemy of the good.
When will you know if you're successful?
Well, that's not the goal. I'm already successful. So the goal is to now just work the rest of my life and leave a great fact pattern for other people to copy.
I don't mean you personally. I mean, when will you, what would you consider a win?
It's the process now that's winning. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing numerical I care for. There's no validation externally that I care for. I could not care less. What I care about is there a fact pattern that aligns more and more people? Can we create a movement to reframe and rebuild capitalism bottoms up? And that movement is not something that anyone can ever take credit for. But to be a part of it and to sort of like bolster it and to propel it forward, to me, will be an extremely great thing to be a part of for the rest of my life. That's a knock on wood, another 50, 60 years until I'm 90 or 100. And then that's great. You know, I'll clock out and I'll feel like I did my part. But there's no demarcation, and that's sort of, again, why things, when we talk about like what does success look like or what are demarcations, all of those things are the traditional society's infrastructure of ring fencing people and putting them in a box. And I just don't want to live my life that way, because I think what will happen is I am just as subject to the same weak kind of like ego-driven thinking as anybody else. I will succumb and be co-opted by these people if I'm not careful. So I have to remind myself, it's not about success. It's about a process, and it's about creating a roadmap that many of us will copy and reuse and reuse. It's not about credit.
You're also arguing for a new way for companies to go public, for tech companies in particular, or maybe any kind of company to go public by creating this special acquisition company that lets startups go public instantly through a merger. Can you tell us about that idea?
Yeah, I'm glad you're asking. So I actually care less about whether companies go public or not. I care about something that's much more important, which is the flow of human capital to good ideas. And what I mean by that is the following. It takes a really, really amazing team to truly change the world. It takes a lot of really good people who are aligned and who can be committed for many, many, many years. It's not a thing that happens in 2 or 3 or 4 years. And unfortunately, today, we have a very big problem, particularly in Silicon Valley, which is that it is one of the single most expensive places in the world to live. And it is a place where right now, when you fund a company, it goes into increasingly escalating salaries, which then unfortunately goes in the hands of all of the infrastructure that supports you as an engineer or product manager or salesperson to live in San Francisco, which specifically means rent. And so all I see is as salaries go up, rents and the cost of living ratably go up, if not faster. And so nobody's really making money except landlords in San Francisco. So what that happens is it leaves an entire class of people, good, honest, earnest people who want to work on really big ideas, feeling like despite their quote unquote, you know, W-2 income, they feel like they just cannot get ahead. And that's really problematic because then what happens is those people either job hop, right, looking for a path to some, you know, discontinuous improvement in their liquidity, meaning like, you know, get on top of an IPO train, or mm-hmm. they just leave the area entirely and move someplace else. Both are structurally bad because now you're not allowing the best ideas to have a chance of aggregating the best people, which then gives those ideas the best chance of actually coming to fruition. And so the way I think about this is that if we can create a more repeatable path for liquidity, what that does is it allows the best companies to close that loop so that the CEO and the board of those businesses can have a cleaner line of sight to employing people for longer, to being able to hire the best, recruit the best, retain the best, which then basically allows them to have their ideas win. And so the product that we created, which was this IPO 2.0 product, is a mechanism that we hope will be, again, a repeatable roadmap. So, you know, this first one, if it's successful, we expect we will do more, but frankly, we'd be happy to see others do it. Copy it. We don't care about the credit here. But what we would love to see is a system where there is more structured, predictable liquidity for the best companies so that the employees that join in year 2, 3, and 4 can see a line of sight that they believe in and double down. And right now, that doesn't exist because the best companies in years 9, 10, and 11 are still private. And I think it's quite problematic for how we think about company building.
Why isn't the IPO market that vehicle?
I think the IPO market can be if we actually restructured it and asked the question, how should the IPO markets actually work? And so, you know, just to double click into that for a second, let's just say you ran a company and I ran a company today, and we both decided to go public. Well, let me give you what you will go through. If you go through the traditional process, and then I'll tell you what I would go through using IPO 2.0. So in your traditional process, you will get a bunch of very traditional investment banks around a table. They will quote unquote bid for your business. You will never get only one bank. You will have to pick a whole conglomerate of banks, 3, 4, or 5 of them. Then what they will do is they will start in a registration process with the SEC. They will write a multi-hundred page report that you as the CEO will have to comb through because it is your voice, it is your words, it represents your business. It will probably take at least 1 year of your time. At the end of that year, what you will do through that registration process is then go on what's called the roadshow. You will meet hundreds and hundreds of potential investors in non-intimate settings, which means that what you probably will not get a chance to do is spend anything more than 20 to 40 minutes with anybody. And so you will have met, quote unquote, hundreds of investors who understand the business. And then what will happen is the banks will then allocate a bunch of stock to those clients of theirs who portend to be your long-term investors. They will price the stock, and on average, they price the stock 50 to 100% cheaper than what the market will bear. So that then on day one and day two, when the stock pops, those clients, again, who are customers of the bank in many other realms, can decide what to do with it. They can make some quick profits. They can sell it. They don't have to do anything with it. But most of them just actually exit. Then what you're left with is a very volatile system. And still, you have not gotten any liquidity, nor have your employees. Now, markets inch along. 2 or 3 quarters later, you'll try to basically, you know, do well by your investors by outperforming in the public markets, which most of these companies do. Most of the companies that go public, tech companies, outperform in their first few quarters by between 5 and 10%. Yet the stock will trade down because most of those companies, despite the fact that you overperform, trade down 5 to 10%. That's over and above whatever volatility has been put into the stock when all of the people who've been giving your stock cheap sell it. And then in month 6, you and your employees can have a chance to sell. And typically, your stock price will be at or below the IPO price. So now that's your process. And again, starting today, you will have liquidity 18 months from now. Now here's my process. You and I will sit down. I will sit down. And now I will sit down with the IPO team. I will explain my business to them. They will develop some very detailed bottoms-up models. Again, the same infrastructure that we use at Social Capital to help make our companies better. We will then go and educate the 25 investors that we've invited into IPOA. These investors we've curated, and we've basically said, and we've set expectations, this is not about a quick flip. This is about building a relationship with this company, having a deep, meaningful opportunity to understand the business and supporting them through their life as a public company. We will develop a model that we all agree with. Then we will develop a price that you agree with, your board agrees with, the IPO team agrees with, and these investors agree with, which probably has a better chance of minimizing this one-day pop, which means that there's less dilution for you and, frankly, more money for you. And then you'll go public, and the entire process will have taken somewhere between 60 and 90 days. And at the end of that, you can decide who's actually locked up or not locked up, and your employees can actually sell if they wanted to on day one, as could you. Mm-hmm. So now if you compare these two side by side, your process is 18 months, your price is unclear, your volatility is unclear, my process is 60 to 90 days, your price is known, your business is known, there's less volatility and you're liquid.
I guess the only question I have left is how is your business known? Because you could argue in amongst all of the process that you laid out, there is oversight. There are public filings.
No offense. Well, you'll still continue to file publicly. But look, let's be very clear. There is a vacuum right now of people who have had a good track record of being good pickers publicly about the future. Okay? In the last generation, there was an investing class that has become unbelievably famous for prescient and consistent picking. Okay? Stan Druckenmiller, George Soros, Paul Tudor Jones, Dan Loeb, David Einhorn. There's a class. These names are known. In our generation, there is an emerging class. And as it turns out, we are one of them. We picked Amazon before people. We picked Tesla before people. We picked Bitcoin in 2013. We are good pickers. We picked Slack in the Series A. And so I think that if we wrap ourselves around a business, A, you'll be much better known, frankly, than if some nameless, faceless analyst at some nameless, faceless bank takes you public. And also B, people will assign more credibility if I actually go out there and say, you know what, I've taken a chance to really understand this business. This business is amazing. And here's how I think about it.
So you don't think that there are companies that need to be tested by the public markets in terms of their business model? You think it's okay to say?
No, but I don't understand what you're saying. Like, you're still tested by the public markets. The result is the same.
Okay.
The result is your stock and you're out there. Anybody can buy it. Anybody can sell it. The difference is the on-ramp to that superhighway. And what I'm telling you is there's a bumbling on-ramp or there's a fast-track path.
Let's pivot quickly because I know we both have to go to the kind of overall culture in the Valley and this question of oversight, because there does seem to be an increasing conversation about how much of a role venture capitalists should play and investors should play in helping to structure the culture of a company. Where do you fall on that?
This is a superb question. And I think it's a great way to end, frankly. I completely agree with you. There is such a responsibility. And because it's, by the way, this is such a crisp tie back to how we started. I mean, imagine when you're a principal. Principals hold people accountable. Now imagine you're an agent. Agents just don't want to get fired. Okay? And so think about how principals deal with solutions of governance and morality and ethics. And then think about how an agent would deal with an issue of governance, morality, and ethics. And you wonder why we're in a situation where the Valley has, frankly, unbelievably damaged our reputation, frankly, in the last year, in the last couple of years, just based on the behaviors of some of these people. Because there is no oversight by enough principals. And what happens is these agents are so desirous to be around a winning strategy that they just want to hold on for dear life, so they close their eyes. And they completely abdicate their responsibility. So to me, I go back to how I started. It is so crucial for more and more principals to invade the investing ranks. It's so crucial for a more inclusive set of people with a broad and diverse ethical and worldview, not tied to money, to be in the investing class. Because those two cohorts will hold the line much better than agents do. Much better than people who need the job, who want the money, who want the perceived fame, who believe that they are these clairvoyant pickers. These people are a scourge to a better way in which we should behave because they tolerate behaviors. Now, the other thing I would say is a lot of these companies are started by young people. And the problem is that what they want more than anything else is guidance. It's not that they are fundamentally bad. And so when you see them veering away, how do you say, hey, hold on, I'm checking you right now. Here's the guardrail. You crossed it. Get back on the right side.
And how do you do that?
So all roads lead back, I think, in my opinion, to people with a backbone. And yeah. I think people who are principled or people who aren't so desirous of money and title and stature generally have a much better backbone than the people that care about those things.
I mean, do you do that? Do you ask your partners and the people in social capital to go in and say, hey, you need to set up an HR department before you take another step?
Wait, I mean, all these companies have HR departments. Last time I checked, Uber had like a huge HR department. That wasn't the issue.
Well, it seems like it was part of the issue.
I mean, I think the issue was that the culture was rotten. Isn't that right. The issue?
Well, sure. And the HR department was not empowered
to
fix it.
The culture isn't created by an HR department in a company. The culture is created by the CEO.
Right.
Like, these fish rot from the head down. Let's be clear.
So you're saying I'm going to try to sniff out the CEO in the first place?
I'm saying if you're going to fix Enron, you got to start with the CEO.
And never invest? Like, would you never invest in Travis? Would you have said, sorry, I don't like your vibe?
I didn't. We passed.
Is that why?
When you're trying to fix like, you know, the Madoff investment organization, it rots from the head down. Okay, like these companies that are just horrendously run or turn out to be complete frauds always start with one key person, and that person is the person in charge.
Is that why you passed on Uber?
And, you know, I give a lot of credit to my friends at Benchmark because they took a hard line and they said, we are acting as principals. This guy has to go. And they should be applauded because it takes a lot of courage to do that. Again, most other people would have closed their eyes, and Benchmark did not. And they'll get maligned and they'll take a bunch of shots, but they did the right thing. They did the absolute right thing.
We're seeing this extreme moment of founder power, or we have seen that. We saw that balance kind of in the original dot-com boom too. There was a lot of founder power and then they'd bring in a grown-up. And then now we're seeing a return to founder power. Where do you think that this is going to sort of play out? Where are we on the bell curve?
Yeah, the way that you describe it, I actually think is quite accurate, which is it's very much like a pendulum. And I think that, you know, we swing from extreme to extreme. And, you know, there was a period, I would say, in the 90s where there was too much investor power. And then through the 2000s, you had enough iconic founders who could swing the pendulum the other way. The balance should be in the middle. I think, for example, what's happened now at Uber is extremely constructive. You have a thoughtful board. You have a thoughtful investor class. You have a thoughtful CEO. And you have moderate forms of power on each side. And you have a mechanism to share that power in a constructive way for the company and those employees and the people that rely on the service. That is what every company should try to embody. And when a company as good as Uber now has a single voting class and everybody is treated equally, it is very hard for a company that is not as good as Uber to now defend why they think they should be treated differently. And so I think that this Uber moment is now when the founder power pendulum starts to swing the other way. And I think if we can find a way to balance ourselves, to get into the center, everyone will be better off. Extremes of either side just don't work.
Perfect. Chamath, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Molly.